ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good evening and welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, the federal government launches an inquiry into sexual violence in the Defence Force. Also, rescuers desperately searching for survivors after catastrophic floods in several Asian countries. And young members of Generation Z volunteering with charities in the lead up to Christmas.
I love the fact that I'm able to come and visit them every week. And I love to learn about their past as well, because everyone has very interesting stories and I love to listen to these stories.
First this evening, the Minister for Defence Personnel, Matt Keogh, has announced today the federal government is establishing an inquiry into sexual violence in the Australian military. It was recommended by the Royal Commission into Defence and Veteran Suicide last year. The Commission had heard evidence from serving defence members and veterans that they felt they were unable to report being sexually assaulted while serving in the Defence Force for fear they would be punished by their superiors. Others told the Commission they were ostracised after reporting their assaults and forced out of military service. The new inquiry into sexual violence in the military will be led by the Defence and Veterans Services Commission, an independent government body set up to oversee reforms recommended by the Royal Commission. Political reporter Evelyn Manfield is at Parliament House in Canberra. Evelyn, what will this inquiry involve?
It's still a little while off and won't start until mid-next year, but essentially this was a recommendation from the Royal Commission into Defence and Veteran Suicides, recommendation 25, because you'd remember there was a whole volume of the report that was looking into sexual misconduct and sexual violence within the Defence Force. So there will be this independent inquiry. The Australian Human Rights Commission today has opened consultation on the terms of reference. So they're still being finalised through this consultation process. And the Commission will also lead research into the prevalence and effects of military sexual trauma, which is due to be completed by the end of next year.
The minister who made this announcement today, Matt Keogh, also said that the ADF Defence is going to change the way it handles sexual offences. What are some of those changes?
Yeah, so one of them is from next week. If a member of the Defence Force is prosecuted in the military justice system for a sexual offence, their conviction must be reported to civilian police. So that, again, is in response to the Royal Commission. But also, another change is, as the ABC revealed in October, that rather than referring to sexual offences such as, you know, sexual harassment or discrimination, rather than calling it sexual misconduct, it will be labelled sexual violence. So Mr. Keogh, in his address to the National Press Club in Canberra today, said that the scourge of sexual violence within the Defence Force just isn't consistent with the values of the Defence Force and that it must be better at tackling these issues. So he also delivered a pretty strong message for any perpetrators who were listening in today.
If there's one message that I want perpetrators to take from my address today, it is this. If you engage in sexual violence, you can presume that you no longer have a job in our Defence Force. In October, the Chief of the Defence Force released an order of the day reinforcing Defence's position that sexual violence has no place in the organisation. The government will be backing that up with legislative force next year. From next week, Defence will be reporting service convictions of sexual and related offences to the National Police Reference System. This means that personnel who commit civilian equivalent offences can no longer hide their conduct within the military justice system.
The Minister for Defence Personnel, Matt Keogh. And Evelyn, it's taken the government a year to establish this inquiry after the Royal Commission report recommendations. So how is the government tracking more broadly with implementing the Commission's recommendations?
It has been a year. So as you'd remember, there were 122 recommendations. The government agreed, or agreed in principle, as they say, to 104 of them. Mr. Keogh said that there had been an enormous amount of progress. He says that by the end of December, so at the end of this month, the government would have implemented its response to 32. He says another 89 recommendations are in progress or currently under consideration. But by the end of next year, he's set the target that the expectation is 2/3 of all the recommendations will be either in progress or being implemented. So they are making progress, but there is still a long way to go.
Evelyn Manfield reporting for us from Parliament House in Canberra. Donna Manton is a veteran of both the Army and the Air Force and says she was sexually assaulted twice by colleagues during her service. She's now the director of the Athena Project, which supports victims of sexual violence in the military, and she's welcomed the establishment of the inquiry.
I'm really excited about some of the policy and legislative initiatives that they're doing. What I think most of the victim survivors would like to see, though, is how we're going to implement that, how we're actually going to do this cultural change. It's the big piece that's still missing. We're only starting to do this inquiry now a year after it was resulted. So in some ways, we feel like we're a little behind. So hopefully this will move quickly to make those really significant changes that defence needs.
Donna Manton is a survivor of sexual assault in the Australian Defence Force. And if you need help, you can call the National Sexual Violence Counselling Line. That's 1-800-RESPECT. The number is 1-800-737 732. You can also call Lifeline on 13 11 14. Well, after initially proposing to introduce mandatory restrictions or guardrails on the rollout of artificial intelligence, the federal government has today announced a plan for a more hands-off approach. The National AI Plan is emphasising the huge economic benefits that could be generated by the new technology. It includes a blueprint for guiding investment in data centres and worker training. It's also promising to monitor the sector to ensure Australians are protected from the worst harms associated with AI. But experts and interest groups are raising concerns the plan's objectives may not be achieved. Nick Grimm has more.
For Adelaide retiree Heather, artificial intelligence might be useful for generating new and unusual content, but beyond that, she's not so sure.
A little bit concerned about it, that you might get incorrect information, that it might be used in the wrong context, children, students. I don't know. It's new and I don't use it a lot. It's fun, but I don't know if I'd want to take it seriously. I'm not convinced.
Aspiring actor Leo, though, worries it could see creative jobs disappear.
It's kind of like the Wild West right now. Like, we think of outlaws and stuff like a little while ago. I feel like that's kind of what we're in right now. Like, there's no real sort of regulations about it, you know? It's exciting, but at the same time, I don't want it to get to the point where you can kind of just, like, AI generate younger versions of these actors on stage. Like, Paul Newman's going to be in, like, Wolf Creek 3 or something. Like.
But the federal government wants to reassure Australians it's taking the necessary steps to ensure artificial intelligence works with us, not against us. Its new National AI Plan aims to strike the balance between making the most of the economic opportunities it generates while avoiding costs like widespread job losses and other harms. Industry Minister Tim Ayres.
This government has demonstrated we're absolutely up to the task of cracking down hard where there's harms in the digital landscape.
A new AI Safety Institute will be tasked with monitoring the rollout of the technology and provide government with advice on gaps in the law, while still encouraging innovation and the uptake of AI across the economy. The new plan, welcomed by business. Damien Kasabji is the CEO of the Tech Council of Australia.
There are around 30,000 people across the country working full-time on AI. We expect that to be 200,000 by 2030 if we get investment right. So from our perspective, there is a very, very important need here from the government to ensure that we are thinking about ways to promote R&D, investment skills in the sector, as well as thinking about the safety aspects.
And that's the nub of the problem, how to extract the most value from AI while ensuring It doesn't come at too high a price. Dr. Rebecca Moroney is a senior lecturer in the Centre for Change and Complexity in Learning at Adelaide University.
They do have a kind of three-stage strategy around capturing economic opportunities, expanding access to AI benefits for all, and ensuring the safety of Australians using these technologies. It's quite infrastructure heavy, particularly around capturing opportunities. So the government is speaking about building smarter infrastructure and backing Australian AI capability and capacity through developing data sets on Australian data and trying to attract both domestic and international kind of talent and funding, if you like, as well.
But at the end of the day, how important is it that Australia actually actively engages with the rollout of this new technology?
It's fundamental. It's, you know, AI is absolutely already shaping how we live and work, and we need to be able to make sure that all Australians have access to these technologies. It's not a one-size-fits-all magic pill that's going to solve all of our problems, but it's absolutely a fundamental future and current skill that will allow us to live our lives to the best of our abilities, to maximise opportunities, and to have a national framework or a national plan is key to achieving that and a very good next step.
Dr. Rebecca Moroney from Adelaide University. That report from Nick Grimm and Luke Radford. More than 2 years after it was completed, the Albanese government has finally released a report which looked into Parliament's so-called Jobs for Mates culture. The report was commissioned by Labor in 2023 to examine how governments appoint people to public boards. It came after the previous coalition government was accused of awarding dozens of plum positions to former colleagues and supporters. But the Finance Minister, Katie Gallagher, has rejected many of the report's recommendations and is being accused by an independent senator of ignoring the community's call for more integrity in politics. Rachel Mealy has more.
Former Public Service Commissioner Lynell Briggs was given the job of looking into Canberra's culture of jobs for mates. Her report's been stuck in Cabinet for almost 2 years, despite calls from the Coalition and the crossbench to make its contents public. Finance Minister Katie Gallagher says the government will bring in an appointment framework but won't act on many of the report's other recommendations.
We did not, when we commissioned Lynell Briggs, we explained the problem, certainly in the meetings I had with her and I know she had with other ministers. We did not say make all your recommendations and the government's going to agree with every single one of them, Ms. Briggs. It informed, that report informed our thinking about the practical improvements we could make to the appointments process.
Lynell Briggs's report found the current system of political appointments has eroded the public's trust. She says the public sees overpaid political hacks who can't do the jobs they're given properly and who may not be operating the bodies they're appointed to in the public interest. Independent Senator David Pocock, who's been pushing for the report's release, says he's disappointed by the government's response.
Really disappointing response overall. I don't think this is in line with community expectation for a government to say, we know that jobs for mates are a massive problem, for Lynell Briggs to say, well, this is how you solve it, and the government to kind of go, yeah, no, we're still going to allow direct appointments by ministers. I don't think that cuts it.
Shadow Finance Minister James Patterson says former politicians can bring the right skills to appointed roles.
Service in public life should not necessarily preclude someone from being appointed to a public role. There are people who serve in Parliament and in ministerial offices and other places who have value to add to public life after they leave public life, and it's appropriate that they appoint them. And this government, for example, recently appointed a former South Australian Premier to be High Commissioner to London. I'm sure he will do a good job. It's one of those things, actually, former politicians are quite able to perform well a diplomatic role like that. So I don't think we should have a fatwa or a ban on all people who've served in political life, but of course they must be qualified for the roles they're appointed to.
But he's questioned why the Briggs report took so long to be released.
I think it speaks volumes that the minister was so reluctant to publicly release it and has only now done so in the lead up to Christmas after the Parliament's risen for the year.
Geoffrey Watson, SC, is on the board of the Centre for Public Integrity. He says the report's findings apply equally to Labor and the Coalition.
The thing is, we can blame Labor today, but over the last 10 years, I've been blaming both sides whenever they get power. They talk tough when they're in opposition. We're going to bring in an accountable system, merit-based system, and then they get into power, and all of a sudden you find their friends and their political allies, maybe sometimes their donors, are finding themselves appointed to boards with all sorts of advantage attached to them.
He says there's a shadow over political appointments in Australia.
Well, it reveals that the current system is in terrible condition insofar as there continues to be exactly what the public thinks, that is, the appointment of friends, political friends, family and friends, failed politicians to important boards and decision-making roles. Also, it's influencing the ultimate conduct of the various bodies because you know somebody's politics, their choices, so you're influencing the direction of the decision-making.
The Centre for Public Integrity is calling for an audit of all government appointments that have been made while the report's been with the Cabinet.
Rachel Mealy with that report. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. You can hear all our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. In Asia, more than 1,100 people in four countries are now confirmed to have died in the storms and landslides caused by some dramatic tropical weather systems. Those countries are Indonesia, Thailand, Malaysia and Sri Lanka. Karishma Vyas is the ABC's Asia editor. Karishma, what's the latest on the situation in Indonesia?
Well, this is the worst affected country so far that we're seeing. It's the island of Sumatra that's been hit very hard by these extreme weather conditions. We've had confirmation of over 600 people that have died there, and over 500 are still missing. Now, this is a real worry because once these missing are accounted for, the concern is that the death toll is going to spike even further. 28,000 homes have been damaged. The weather is clearing now, thankfully, and this is revealing the true scale of the disaster. And more is becoming apparent about the conditions on the ground. This cyclone ripped through Sumatra, and as it did so, it cut off power and telephone lines. It also triggered landslides that are now blocking roads that are desperately needed to actually access these communities that have been the worst hit.
And what's happening with the rescue operations there in Sumatra, Karishma? It must be a very tough job.
It's a monumental task for these rescue teams. They're trying desperately to deliver emergency aid. We're talking everything from food and water to medical supplies to the people that need it the most. Unfortunately, the helicopters are the only kind of transport system that are able to be deployed to some of these regions. And you can imagine the amount of aid that they can carry is minute compared to what trucks can bring in on the roads. Once these roads are cleared, they're going to be taking in heavy machinery as well as supplies because they need to dig through meters of mud, not just to clear these villages, but also to recover the bodies of victims. We've had terrible reports of rescue workers having to use their bare hands to dig through the mud at the moment because the heavy machinery is just not arriving there fast enough.
And in Sri Lanka, more than 350 people have died after Cyclone Ditwa hit. What's the latest in that country?
Well, we're seeing similar scenes of just devastated communities. What's unique about Sri Lanka is that the entire island nation has been impacted, including the capital, Colombo. We've seen people wading through waist-deep water and being stranded without food and supplies. The president has said that this is the largest and most challenging disaster the country has ever experienced. We're seeing similar destruction of infrastructure, roads, power lines, communication lines. Now, officials say train and flight services have slowly resumed now, but schools have remained closed. The storm is moving away from the island and northwards towards the southern state of Tamil Nadu in India. And over there, we've seen three people that have been killed in weather-related incidents.
And I know you've been speaking to some aid organisations, Karishma. What are they telling you that they need at the moment?
I spoke to a few aid workers from World Vision, and their concerns are twofold. The one is the impact that this disaster is having on people's livelihoods. A lot of these communities that have been affected are agricultural communities, and it could take them a year to recover. Now, what are they going to do in the meantime? How are they going to support themselves and support their families? The other concern that they had is focused on children. A lot of the education infrastructure in these communities have been destroyed or disrupted. There's no school supplies left. Sometimes there's not even a school building that has been left standing. So the education is not only disrupted for these kids, but the worry is some may never return. And this, of course, is going to have lifelong consequences for them. So aid agencies are really urging governments to prioritize rebuilding people's livelihoods, as well as getting the education infrastructure up and running as soon as possible.
And Karishma, how are the governments in the various countries reacting to these disasters?
Interestingly, there has been a lot of criticism. Actually, here in Thailand, last week we saw massive floods in the southern province of Songkhla. We travelled to the capital city there, Hat Yai, and people were furious about the way that their governments had responded to this crisis. Firstly, they said that they were not given enough warning. When they heard about these weather systems coming in, their governments assured them that they had the situation under control and they didn't need to do anything to protect themselves. Of course, within 24 hours, their businesses, their homes were submerged in floodwaters. So there's a lot of anger, and that's been directed towards the Prime Minister, the interim Prime Minister here, who's facing elections in just a few months. But there is genuine public anger over the fact that their governments were not able to warn them or protect them in a time of crisis.
Karishma Vyas is the ABC's Asia editor. One of Australia's biggest charities is reporting an increase in the number of people from Generation Z volunteering to help out in their communities. The Red Cross says 18 to 29-year-olds are making a difference in a variety of roles, especially in the lead up to Christmas. One expert says for many in Generation Z, volunteering helps overcome a sense of isolation. Miwa Bloomer filed this report.
For some young people, lending a hand brings a sense of satisfaction.
A couple of weeks ago, I taught someone about how to use iMessages.
21-year-old Leonardo Lee, who lives in Adelaide, spends his spare time teaching elderly Australians how to use technology.
I connect with them through technology. That's my main job.
He's one of the new generation of young volunteers donating their time to local communities. In this case, he volunteers with the Red Cross.
I love the fact that I'm able to come and visit them every week and learn about what they're up to. I love to learn about their past as well, because everyone has very interesting stories and I love to listen to these stories.
The Red Cross says it's seen a huge influx of Gen Z participants like Leonardo. It's released results of a survey which show 97% of Generation Z respondents say supporting charities during the festive season is important, and 96% say they're likely to prioritise connecting with people in the community who are facing the holiday season alone. Red Cross CEO Andrew Colvin says young volunteers are making big contributions to his organisation.
All Australians are very generous. We know that, particularly at this time of year. What we've been, surprised by is to see how strong that younger Australian cohort has come through. It's quite a great outcome for us to see that young Australians are so keen to support charities and support their communities at this time of year.
Some young volunteers are connecting with their community through a daily call and check-in to an elderly community member, via clothing drives or in disaster situations. Andrew Colvin says people are being driven to volunteer by a desire to give back.
Oh, look, volunteering makes you feel very good about yourself, of course. It gives you an opportunity to give back to the community. We find that our volunteers, doesn't matter how much time you have, you can volunteer a little bit of time, you can volunteer a lot of time.
But perhaps something else is driving Gen Z towards charity work. Associate Professor Michelle Lim from the School of Public Health at the University of Sydney also heads up a group called Ending Loneliness Together. She's done research showing more than 2 in 5 young Australians between 16 and 25 feel lonely. And volunteering is one of the ways they can help combat that loneliness.
So what we do know in terms of loneliness in young Australians is that more than 2 in 5 young Australians aged between 16 to 25 feel lonely. And about 1 in 4 young Australians experience what we call loneliness at any given time. But about 1 in 7 experience what we call persistent loneliness. So loneliness that's ongoing for at least 2 years. Volunteering is one way of really connecting with other people and also helps people find meaning and purpose in the things that they do. And so volunteering is really a wonderful source of social connection for people who might feel lonely.
That's Associate Professor Michelle Lim from Sydney University. Miwa Bloomer reporting. Thanks for joining me for PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. The podcast of the full program is available on the ABC Listen app. And we'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Good night.
Hello, I'm Sydney Peed from the ABC News Daily podcast. In a flurry of peace talks, Ukrainian officials have been desperately trying to avoid an unfair end to Russia's war. Today, an international relations expert, Rajan Menon, on whether this latest round of diplomacy offers any real hope and what Kyiv may still have to give up. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.